I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last winter, President Obama cited 3D printing in his State of the Union address, saying that it has the potential to revolutionize the way we make almost everything. This relatively new technology seems to be doing just that, designing and creating prosthetic body parts, toys, artwork, architecture, food, dental products, guns. A Philadelphia city councilman just introduced legislation that would ban the manufacture of firearms by individuals using a 3D printer. Well, we were curious about the evolution of 3D printing and where it's going, our topic for today's Radio Times, and we have three guests who have joined us. Joseph Flaherty writes about design, DIY, and the intersection of physical and digital products for Wired. He also designs award-winning medical devices and apps for smartphones at AGA Matrix. And Joe Flaherty joining us by telephone. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
Also with us is Hod Lipson, and he's a professor of engineering at Cornell University, co-author of a relatively new book called Fabricated, the New World of 3D Printing. Hod Lipson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
And also joining us from the studios of Cornell University is Melba Kerman, also a writer and technology analyst and the other author of Fabricated, the New World of 3D Printing. And Melba, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Hod, let me begin with you, and I think we just have to put some basics on the table because I saw that 3D printing is also referred to as additive manufacturing. Help us understand the basics of 3D printing. How does it work?
That's right. The technology has a number of different names. 3D printing is the more colloquial name by which it's known to most people. It's a process that very much like a regular printer prints pictures by generating drops of ink on a piece of paper. A 3D printer places droplets or streams of plastic onto a plate, gradually building up a three-dimensional object. So not a picture of a cup of coffee, but the coffee cup itself, out of which you can drink, a real three-dimensional process. And it can work with plastics, with metals, with ceramics, with a whole range of materials. But whichever technology it is, it always builds up an object layer by layer.
And you need a printer to do this, Hod?
That's right. So you need some kind of 3D printer to do that. It's a special machine, depending on, there's about two dozen different technologies under that name that work in different ways with different materials. Some of them are consumer scale machines that can work on your desktop. Some of them industrial scale that are a size of a refrigerator. But they're all sort of fairly compact machine that builds up objects layer by layer.
And Joe, how old or how new is this technology? Do we have Joe?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry we had a little glitch there. Go ahead. You're on
no
the air.
Problem.
Yeah.
So I was just saying that the 3D printing technology is about 25 years old. It came out of some universities that were doing advanced research on material science. And over the last 25 years, the technology went from being a machine that was something that was the size of a refrigerator that costs as much as a Porsche mm-hmm. to being a device that can sit on your desktop and can be had for about $3,000. So it's really not a new technology. The big story here, though, is how affordable and how accessible it's become in the last 5 years or so.
I was reading about this guy named Chuck Hall, and should we credit him with starting this technology?
Yeah, he's widely credited as being the father of 3D printing, and there's a great story about how, sort of like Edison, when he was working on some of his inventions, he tried and tried and tried again until one morning at 3 a.m. he called up his wife and was from his lab, and she came down and saw that he had printed a tiny little teapot made of plastic on this device. And from that very crude prototype, a $5 billion industry has emerged.
Melba, let me get you in on the conversation here. So are we sort of just at the beginning, the cusp of how 3D printing is going to revolutionize manufacturing?
Yes, we're absolutely at the beginning. And I think one of the important things to remember is that it's not just the 3D printer that's bringing about this major shift. It's actually a convergence of many different technologies. And one of the critical components of this tipping point that we're getting to is actually computing power. And so one of the most powerful and, I think, breakthrough elements of the 3D printing is the fact that it speaks digital, or it's computer-guided in a way that we, at a level that no other manufacturing machine has been yet thus far.
So we're talking about digital meets analog, Melba?
Essentially, yes. And we've got a long ways to go. But if you look at the past, we've already digitized music. We've already digitized music and information. And what we're finally reaching the point now, and this is going to take decades, of course, But we're finally going to have the tool we need to start outputting some of the creativity and variation of the digital world into the physical world.
We posted something on our Facebook page, and I think that, I know that the largest response was questions and concerns about the idea that people could, using a 3D printer, make a gun. And let me put that first to you, Hod. Is it possible to make a gun with a 3D printer today?
Absolutely. It's possible. It has been possible for a long time. We've seen a couple of, maybe 2-3 years ago, the first sort of plastic guns were printed, and more recently a full metal gun was printed. It is possible, and it's fairly easy to do, and I think that's sort of the both interesting and worrying part, is that almost anybody with access to a machine like this and the appropriate blueprint, electronic blueprint, can fabricate a firearm.
Quite worrisome, I would say, Joe.
Yeah, I think there are two things to look at, though. One is that the prospect of making a 3D printed gun sounds futuristic, but you could go to Home Depot and buy all the machines and materials you needed to make a firearm quite easily. So the push-button nature of it does make it a bit more scary, but I don't think we're entering a bold new world with this technology.
Even if it were made of plastic and perhaps not detectable by scanners, things like that, Joe?
Oh, no, there's actually a bunch of research in this space, and people have shown that you can actually build bombs and other sorts of weapons using just the materials that you can purchase after you go through airport security. So I think in terms of the things that could really, you know, pose danger to airline safety and things like that, 3D printed guns would be fairly low on the list. And I think there's actually a lot you could look at in 3D printers. Guns are one thing you could produce, but scientists are using 3D printers to, you know, print replacement body parts and all sorts of wonderful medical advances. So while there is definitely a threat in terms of the firearm side of things, I think there's a much bigger upside in terms of all of the medical applications.
And Melba, just picking up on that, I mean, it seems that that is what new technology does, which is it can be used for things that sound kind of scary, and then, of course, it can be used for things that, that could really improve things like recovery from loss of limb in a war, for instance.
Yeah, I think that that's a great point, Marty, is that like any powerful technology, and if you look at computers, automobiles, they all have the potential to do great good, and they also have the potential to do great harm. And 3D printing is absolutely a powerful, game-changing technology. Some people call that a platform technology. And it can be applied either way.
The gun issue is, I think, a little bit more complicated than meets the eye. The issue with the guns is not so much that it is possible, but the fact that it is possible with almost no resources. The fact that somebody with zero training can do that in the privacy of their own garage and make a gun that is not a good gun by any means. It's not a gun that we'd use in military or criminal activity, but it might work a little bit. And the fact that, let's say, children, teenagers can basically download the blueprint and make a gun that is not a good gun is actually the worrying part aspect of this, because it's not a safe device. It might actually injure the user, and I think that brings up a whole different aspect of 3D printing, which we're just beginning to appreciate, is the fact that is safety and quality control. When you have sort of distributed manufacturing where people download things, how do you know that they work, that they're safe, that they're designed properly for what their proposed intention is? If you print a bicycle helmet, how do you know that it's appropriate? We've gone through a lot of work with conventional manufacturing to make sure that things are safe, to have consumer reliability checks, and now we have to rethink some of these issues.
Well, Joe, let me toss that back to you as someone that writes about DIY. Does some of these safety issues concern you?
Yeah, I think they are obviously something that the industry is going to have to grapple with, and I think you look at some of the leaders in the space. So MakerBot runs a site called Thingiverse, which allows people to go online and download digital files that can be 3D printed as easily as you could download music from Apple. And they made a pretty bold move early on, banning the parts of any guns from being listed on their site. So I think there'll always be back channels where these things can be found, but I think that's been true through the entire history of the Internet, whether it was, you know, the early days in the Anarchist Cookbook or some of the more disquieting things you can find today. And it really, I think, will be up to companies at first, and then, you know, eventually, I'm sure government regulators will step in as is happening locally.
Yes, as I said, Philadelphia City Councilman introducing legislation banning the manufacture of firearms by an individual using a 3D printer. If I could go back to you, Melvin, and just even picking up on this idea, I guess the more the celebratory parts of 3D printing, the idea that someone coming back from war with a, you know, a loss of a limb, the idea that they could get through 3D printing a new arm, a new leg.
So, yeah, I think that that is one of the more celebratory aspects of this technology. And earlier, actually, just before we came on, you were talking about organ replacement and how there's a 8,000-person waiting list in the state of Pennsylvania alone. And you also bring up returning veterans. And so right now we're at the very early stages of this technology, but researchers have proven right now that you can print simple tissue like skin and cartilage, simple tissue that doesn't have a whole lot of veins, doesn't have a whole lot of different types of stem cells in it. But, you know, speaking of converging technologies, there's also been a tremendous advance in medical imaging technology. And so when you think about that, a bioprinter that's printing in a living ink of stem cells, it can actually is guided by these advances in medical imaging technology. So, again, there's this fabulous convergence. And I think one of the things that I actually think is unfortunate, it's a double-edged sword, is that this concern about printed weapons is actually one of the ways that many people have heard about 3D printing for the first time.
Right.
So it's fantastic that they are starting to become aware of the potential of this new technology. But then the downside is that's creating a perception of 3D printing that unfortunately overlooks all of the positive characteristics or all the positive things that it's capable of doing.
And about a minute before our first break here, and Melba, let me go back to you and just picking up on what you just said there. Is it possible then to transplant a 3D, arm or hand, for instance?
Not yet. But if current trends continue, it'll take a couple decades. I don't want to overpromise anything, but if research continues at the pace that it's going, medical imaging technology continues to advance, and stem cell research continues to advance, we will definitely get there.
So what we're seeing is a convergence of all these sort of new technologies or even biologies, I guess, coming together.
Yep, even as absolutely advances in biotech research as well are fueling this.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the evolution and future of 3D printing, talking with Melba Kerman and Hod Lipson, co-authors of a new book called Fabricated, The New World of 3D Printing, and it's also the promise and peril of a machine that can make almost anything. And they join us from the studios of Columbia University. Also with us is Joseph Flaherty, and he's joining us by telephone. He writes about design, DIY, and the intersection of physical and digital products for Wired. So if you have any questions about DIY, this is the place to call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
AS1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. From the creative team that brought you This Is the Week That Is and our show of shows, 1812 Productions celebrates the holidays with its newest original production, The Big Time, New Vaudeville for the Holidays, featuring Jennifer Childs, Scott Greer, and Dave Jadico. The Big Time reunites Philadelphia's comedy dream team and brings the steamer trunk circuit into the 21st century. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
What is The Pulse? Stories at the heart of health science and innovation. WHYY-FM's newest original program launches Friday morning, December 6th at 9. The critical issues and innovations as told by patients, doctors, researchers, and everyday people. Plus, an active and growing online multimedia destination at whyy.org/thepulse. The Pulse launches Friday morning, December 6th at 9 on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, heritage turkeys are bringing a different flavor to the Thanksgiving table and a different color to the barnyard.
The heritage breeds are a lot of different colors, from black to gray to kind of a lavender blue color. The commercial birds are all white.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we're talking about how 3D printing is shaking up product design. And again, our guests are Melba Kerman, Hod Lipson, and Joe Flaherty. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Joe, it seems like almost every week you're writing about something new that's developing in the world of 3D printing. What's the most sort of jaw-dropping thing that you have been writing about?
I think two things. One is the spread of the technology into different areas. I think, as we just heard, the idea that you can print a replacement artery for your heart in the not-too-distant future is probably the most mind-blowing of all these things. I think in sort of more approachable terms, though, just how widespread it's become. So now if you go to Disney World, instead of buying a little souvenir character, princess, you can actually have your face scanned and then superimposed on the body of the princess of your choosing, and it's 3D printed there while you wait. So I think the idea that this thing that was a fantastic technology that was really limited to Star Trek television shows 10 years ago is now being something as easy to buy as a souvenir at a gift shop.
Which makes me wonder whether things like 3D in cinema, you know, live-action technology, all the stuff that we've been able to see on the screen, whether you think, Joe, that has been part of this development and evolution of 3D printing.
Oh, no question. I think one of the things that's really exciting about this phase of 3D printing is that it's moving beyond the world of engineering. I think the last 10 or 20 years have been marked by the technology being used to make prototypes of new consumer electronics or other kinds of devices. I think what we're seeing now with the rise of 3D models in movies, and particularly in video games, mm-hmm. is that there's a huge library of content that can be fed into the printers. So now kids who play Minecraft, they can craft these magical worlds and then go to a service and actually have their land 3D printed for a relatively small fee.
Help us understand what 3D printing of food would entail. What is that about? And what would be the reason for it?
So 3D printing of food is sort of related closely to bioprinting. The idea is that you, instead of printing with plastic or with metal, you print with biological material or food materials. And we started, we open sourced one of our 3D printers back in 2005. And when we open sourced it, the first thing that people started doing with it was to print in chocolate, in cookie dough, in peanut butter, and those kinds of materials. So we've been, in the beginning was a sort of frivolous activity that you do on the side, but at some point we realized this is actually interesting for many reasons. One, it's a way to sort of embed, to control nutrition, to embed medicine, to do a lot more with food than we can do with conventional manufacturing. It's a way to sort of increase variety of foods that you can make with a relatively small set of ingredients. I've also seen it work magic in schools. When you bring a cookie printer into a classroom, kids who couldn't care less about science, math, manufacturing suddenly get engaged, and they ask questions about making it this way and that way and changing their program. So it's all about working with food materials to combine materials in lots of different ways to make many interesting edible constructs.
Melba, even looking into the future, is it possible to imagine using 3D printing of food as a way to deal with hunger and starvation and food insecurity around the world?
I think it's going to be one powerful tool that needs to be put into an arsenal of other powerful tools. And I think one of the interesting things about printing food is that we keep learning this in other ways, but the hardest thing to print is actually fresh produce.
I was
wondering
about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and here's one of the amazing things that as I continue to learn more and more about cutting-edge technologies, the thing that we keep coming back to is the more technologically sophisticated we become, the more we keep rediscovering that nature is the most ingenious and sophisticated designer there is. And so as we're looking at 3D printing technologies in food, and of course also in bioprinting and other art and architecture forms, is that as the technologies improve, we're finally starting to get a little bit better at mimicking Mother Nature. But with that said, we explore this issue in our book, Fabricated, actually, is if you think about 3D printing a hamburger, let's say.
Sure.
Printing that meat, not a big deal. It can be done today. You might have to struggle a bit with frying the burger, because clearly it's not going to come out of the printer fried. Printing the bun, we'll get there. But when it comes to printing the lettuce, tomato, and onion, that's actually going to be the hardest part.
And why is that?
Because it's a living, those are living plants or living vegetables. And it's one thing to print cookie dough, but it's another thing if you actually were to take apart a lettuce leaf, say, cell by cell, examine all the different materials, for lack of a better word, that make up that leaf, the internal structures. That actually is a marvel of engineering.
And, of course, there is the issue of cost effectiveness, huh? Especially when you're thinking of 3D printing of a hamburger.
Exactly. You can go to McDonald's and get a pretty tasty hamburger for not a whole lot. And what we don't realize when we buy that burger, unless you're maybe a food rights activist, is there's a massive global supply chain that sits behind that burger. And that the efficiencies of that global supply chain are actually what makes that burger cheap. But when you're 3D printing, one of the beautiful and radical things about 3D printing is it's wonderful at making custom designs. You were earlier talking about avatars and video game figures. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't mass produce very well.
And that would be, I guess, a challenge going forward, Hod, is trying to figure out how to mass produce 3D printing.
Well, I think the big advantage of 3D printers is their ability to produce very complex shapes in small quantities. And that is exactly the opposite of mass production, which specializes in producing simple shapes at mass quantities. And so it's a very different sort of manufacturing paradigm. But the converse here is that the same machine can produce a lot of different things. So it's in a way, it's really rethinking production. And if all we want to do is replace mass-produced things with 3D printing, that's not going to happen anytime soon. It's going to take a long time. But what you can see really is happening is people are finding new ways to make things that take advantage of the ability to make very complex things in small batches. People are making, for example, custom orthodontics, which are produced one at a time, each one of them customized, and that's something you couldn't even conceive of, wouldn't be commercially viable using mass production. So it's not necessarily about replacing mass production or meeting those specifications, but it's really about rethinking design, rethinking business models to take advantage of this newfound capability.
Joe, anything you want to add to what Melba and Hod were just talking about?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think we're moving with these devices from an age of mass production to one of mass customization, where the product quality that you receive is as good as anything you get off a production line, but it's uniquely tailored for your specific needs, which is different, but in many ways a great improvement on the situation.
I do want to get to our callers, Joe, but someone did post on our Facebook page, would they be able to print me a playable guitar? Is that possible, Joe?
It's possible, and it's actually already done. There are a number of people who are actually printing all sorts of fantastic instruments, from traditional guitars to crazy flute-like objects that wouldn't be possible with traditional manufacturing processes.
And that's Joe Flaherty. Joseph Flaherty writes about design, DIY, and the intersection of physical and digital products for Wired. Also with us, Hod Lipson and Melba Kerman, and they are co-authors of a book called Fabricated, The New World of 3D Printing. Hod is a professor of engineering at Cornell University, and Melba is a writer and technology analyst, and they are joining us from the studios of Cornell University. We have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments about 3D printing, this is a place to call. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me get to, looks like Ed from Conshohocken to join our conversation. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm just curious on what is the most used 3D software? I'm familiar with MicroStation and AutoCAD. I know a lot of the folks coming out of college today are getting into 3D softwares, but I'm just curious to which one is the most used in mechanical design. because I see just the promise of prototyping there is just absolutely amazing. Well, and I'll take my call off the air.
Sure.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Joe, can I start with you on that one?
Yeah, sure. In terms of the most used engineering software, something like SolidWorks or AutoCAD, like you mentioned, are pretty widely used. I would say that one of the really fascinating things about 3D printing is how wide the software world has gotten. So there are now apps that you can download for free that allow you to take a picture of an object, say a lamp on a table, and then have it converted into a 3D file that's ready to print almost immediately. So there's a whole range of different solutions.
Hi, do you want to add anything to Ed's question?
And I think that's a very good characterization. There's sort of, I think the biggest gap right now in utilizing technology is actually the software. The design tools are not keeping pace with the capability of the manufacturing machines. 3D printers can make very, very complex shapes, but computer-aided design software is still not there in terms of allowing people to access that new design space. So while there are quite a few different software packages out there, there's a sort of a growing need for new ways of thinking about design that will allow people without a lot of engineering training to access this incredible design space.
Melba, you want to add anything?
Yeah, so it's clear that given the fact that 3D printing technologies are a couple decades old and they have their roots in industrial design, there are the mainstream engineering design software packages are pretty effective tools, and they're widely taught, widely known. But I think the future of design software is going to become very broad, like Joe was saying. And the buzzword that I'm hearing that I actually really like is called digital capture.
Hmm.
And as scanning technologies improve and as the computing power capacity increases, computing design software, or CAD as people call it, is getting easier and easier to use, almost to the point where children and consumers can pick it up and start playing. So I think that when digital capture becomes the norm, that's going to become a whole new way that we reconceptualize how we use computers to design things.
And thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Dave from Chestnut Hill has to say. Dave, go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Hi, Marty. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I was wondering if your guests could speak to the implications or potential benefits, really, of this technology in third world countries, particularly for gaining local control and local capacity over manufacturing processes there.
Dave, let me toss that to Hod Lipson first. You want to take that, Hod?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. The fact that these machines are very portable, they're very small, they don't require a lot of training to use, really brings manufacturing to places where normally manufacturing and certainly digital manufacturing would not be the norm. And that is essentially a very empowering tool. It allows people to make things where and when they need them, and allows them to design things without having to go through sort of corporate channels and other constraints. And we're seeing that happening more and more. I think it's in the book we call it micro factories, very much like microfinancing has allowed a lot of people to take off in new ways. I think this ability to fabricate things is very empowering. It's also opening up the need and thirst for education in places where that wasn't necessarily prevalent.
What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, I think one of the really exciting things here is that it kind of changes the model. So, you know, if somebody wanted to bring aid to the third world a decade ago, they might try to raise money from wealthy investors and buy off-the-shelf medical devices. What I've seen a lot of recently, though, are people who might have done that a decade ago are now saying, well, why don't we just build a lower-cost device and then bring that to these developing countries? So they'll make a new endoscope, say, and the final product won't be 3D printed. But because the tools are so accessible, they can do all of the R&D and prototyping and get something that's functional before transitioning it to mass manufacturing and then bringing these tools all across the world.
Dave, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Melba, if I can toss something to you, what are some of the questions about, I guess, copyright or patenting, patent infringement? How does that play into our conversation about 3D printing?
So I think that is definitely one of the big looming legal issues that lie ahead, not just consumer safety and gun control laws, but intellectual property challenges. And the way I see it is that there's two major zones of IP issues. One is the known zone, which we're already familiar with from other industries, which is companies that have a 3D printing technology want to patent it. And there's already been discussions, disputes about those particular patents and copyright issues. But the new frontier, which we're now just starting to reach, is this capacity we are gaining to actually rip, mix, and burn the physical world in the way that we've already gotten pretty adept at ripping, mixing, and burning the digital world. And so my hope is that we have learned our lesson over the past 15 years with digital music and media and sort of the Napster moments that we've already experienced, that they weren't necessarily, didn't go as smoothly as they could have. And so with 3D printing, we're now going to reach the point where we can actually design, edit, and replicate copyrighted and patented items, and we're going to start to be asking ourselves hard questions of what exactly constitutes a copyright violation, or is that new widget you just printed that's a minor variation of the original, maybe you just printed it out in a new material, say, is that actually a patent violation?
Well, I wonder, Joe, from your perspective and even reporting, do you think we have resolved what came out of the whole Napster brouhaha?
Yes, a lot of the legal infrastructure that was set up in response to that, so the DCMA, which is often used to have videos pulled off YouTube, for instance, has already been applied in some cases with 3D printing. There are some famous cases where people were making homages to game characters, not even direct replicas of the game characters, and the companies that own the intellectual property asked the hosting site that had these files to take them down. So we're definitely in the thick of it, and I think as the technology becomes more widespread and critically, as it becomes a higher resolution technology, we're going to see more and more of this.
Do you agree with that, Han?
I think the challenge is going to be a little bit more difficult because most things that you can print, if you, let's say, copy a door handle in your car, that door handle is probably not patented because there's nothing ingenious about the mechanism. It's not copyright protected because it has a utility. And it's if it doesn't have a trademark on it, it's not protected by trademark law. So it's somewhere most things that you would copy and reproduce are not protected by current copyright, patent, and trademark laws at all. And even design patent has its limits. So I think we're really going into a new area, and we have to find a balance between the need to protect people's creativity and work in intellectual property and the need to explore and design and advance things freely. And finding that balance is going to be, I think, a little bit trickier than digital music.
Why do you think so?
Again, because there's a lot of when you talk about music, it's very clearly in the copyright area. Music file or like an art picture doesn't have utility, so it falls very neatly into that category. But when you're copying a door handle, or something like that, it has utility. It's very difficult to identify what constitutes innovation, what's copying, what's a minor variation. All these things are much more difficult because it's a sort of you're talking about shapes, you're talking about utility, and we just haven't been there yet. And also, I think it's different because a lot more people can design things than people can write music, let's say, or even write text. And so it's a much bigger audience. It's a lot of people.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the world, the future, the evolution of 3D printing. And again, our guests are Hod Lipson, Melba Kerman, and Joe Flaherty. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, questions, comments. Go to radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Celebrate the Jewish Festival of Lights with Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind. Join us for a delightful and moving hour of songs sung by the Western Wind and holiday stories told by the inimitable Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. It's Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind in Hanukkah and Story and Song from PRI.
Wednesday night at 10 on WHYY.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a rising star in politics when he was crippled by polio at the age of 39. On the next Fresh Air, historian James Tobin says despite modern misconceptions, Roosevelt's polio was well known to the public and even became an important part of his personal narrative as he campaigned for the White House. Tobin's book is The Man He Became. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Blended families with children have a lot on their plates. Defining roles, understanding loyalties, paying attention to one another's needs, noticing what works and what doesn't work to foster a healthy stepfamily. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, we'll hear from blended families expert Patricia Papernow, author of Surviving and Thriving in Stepfamily Relationships, today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the brave new world of 3D printing, how the technology is shaking up product design. And again, our guests are Melba Kerman and Hod Lipson, co-author of a book called Fabricated, The New World of 3D Printing. They join us from the studios of Cornell University. Also with us is Joseph Flaherty, and he writes about design, DIY, and the intersection of physical and digital products for Wired. And again, we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We had an email from Glenn from Hamilton, New Jersey. Where do they foresee the best monetization opportunities around 3D printing? And Joe, let me toss that first to you. What do you see?
Oh, sure. I think the clear winner right now and in the future is going to be medical applications. So these titanium hip implants, replacement parts of your skull if you're in a traumatic accident, I mean, these are multi-billion dollar industries, and companies already in them are making pretty healthy returns. I think where it's also interesting is it's not necessarily just going to be products that lead to revenue gains. So I know a number of companies are trying to make 3D data gained from MRIs and from CAT scans useful during operation procedures. So if a doctor can make a jig that holds your knee in the perfect position to perform a surgery, that can save hours of time and, over the course of years, millions and millions of dollars. So medical would probably be the best bet.
Do you agree with that, Melba?
I do, absolutely. I think looking in the future, one of the things that I'm really optimistic about is going to be a new services industry. And so if you look at the software industry, 30 years ago, nobody would have guessed the global network of small service providers, small shops, small startups that are able to provide some kind of service in the digital space, whether it's managing information, storing data in databases. And so I think looking forward, we're also going to see a similar rich ecosystem around 3D printing manufacturing and services.
Do you see this as a job creator, Hod, when we look at 3D printing?
Oh, this is a really interesting question. It takes away some jobs and it creates some at the same time. It definitely changes manufacturing. It makes a lot of things that previously needed a lot of specialty, special training go away and makes them automated. But it also creates a lot of opportunities for new businesses. And part of the challenge, I think, we're a little bit, it's as if we had this conversation back in the 70s trying to predict how computers are going to be used. And certain things are easy to predict. Were easy to predict back then that computers are going to revolutionize accounting and military calculations. And so we can see today, similarly, that 3D printing is going to change certain sectors. But what's really exciting to me are all the new business models that are opening up because this idea of mass customization, of new service models that are just impossible to predict today, but people are coming up left and right with these kinds of ideas, and we'll see where that will go.
Is this another step towards the world of robots, Joe?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the beautiful thing here is it's going to make industrial-scale robot production more easy, but I think, as Hod alluded to earlier, bringing these devices into schools and teaching engineering and science topics in a way that the end result isn't a final exam but a functional robot that a group of students have built is something that you just can't bring to life really any other way. So while I think we will probably on net lose some manufacturing jobs, I think the way the tool can be used to teach STEM education, especially in the early grades, will be really transformative.
I do want to get back to our callers, but Melba, we do have another email question. This goes back to the hamburger that you were talking about. Uh-huh. Why is meat easier to print than produce?
So if you think the way to understand this is if you think about food being processed, And so any food that's already been pre-processed is straightforward to print. And I guess I should add to that, any food that can be squeezed through some kind of nozzle or syringe can be 3D printed.
So, yum.
Yeah, delightful. But a hamburger meat is already, it's been already, you know, processed and basically chewed up already, that it can be formed fairly easily. But contrast that with a wonderful piece of high-quality steak that's been intact. It hasn't been chewed up, processed, ground up. That actually is much more challenging to print. And there's some very interesting research coming out of the Netherlands right now in 3D printing imitation meat, which if you think about beef, is one of our worst offenders. It's environmentally really expensive to produce a pound of steak. However, 3D printing a nice, delicate, tasty piece of steak is much more difficult than printing a burger.
Interesting. Thanks for the email. Let's see what looks like Ken from Newark, Delaware has to say. Ken, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I love the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to know what the thoughts were on things like drugs and illegal substances being printed, and also on top of that, when drugs go generic, would users be able to, you know, print their own medications?
That's an interesting question. Hod, can I toss that to you?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I think drugs and medication are really materials, the shape doesn't really matter with these things. So I think I don't think 3D printer directly affects that area. It does, however, allow creating what some people call reaction wear, sort of tools that people can use to make these things and explore them more easily at home. So it's sort of a catalyst to the development of these things. And of course, when you're talking about food printing, you can imagine a future where you embed nutrients and medicine in food at the exact at the right level as prescribed by a doctor. So there's a lot of opportunities there, but I don't think it revolutionizes that aspect in any deep way.
I feel like I've seen that movie somewhere. Thanks for the call, Ken, to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about the future, the evolution of 3D printing. Melba, let me go back to you, because one of the things that you write about in this book, and there should be no surprise here, it's because of the way that pornography and sex really has powered so much of the internet. How do you see 3D printing and things like sex toys?
So I think it's going to be similar. When the internet developed, back in the early days, the two big drivers of the internet were basically sex and money. It was a big underground porn industry that fueled the development of the internet, as well as people trying to get their stock prices at the, you know, at the shortest time possible. So with 3D printing, there already is, in fact, a similar industry that has tremendous financial potential. But nobody's quite sure how they want to talk about it yet. And when we wrote this book, actually, we really went back and forth, because we really want to mention it, but we also didn't want to spend too much time on it, because we wanted not to distract people with, distracting speculation about, what exactly can you print? And how do you get that digital capture initially? You know, it leads to all kinds of very interesting and lurid discussions. But there is absolutely going to be, and there already are, small shops that in the privacy of the design studio, people can start to, you know, design and 3D print things that are very special and custom. When you think about customization, this is one of the perhaps ultimate examples of the power and the value of customization in designing physical objects, as in the sex industry.
And Joe, we shouldn't be surprised about that, should we?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, one of the really fantastic things about 3D printing is how it can really be applied to almost any industry. So the industry is one. I think there are others where you'd say, you know, you couldn't get further from it, where it's a bunch of research biologists sitting in the lab and looking at the Great Barrier Reef and saying, well, there's this huge problem where there's erosion of this natural structure. And so where, you know, you might create something that can reach out and touch you, these guys are saying, well, what if we made a 3D printer that was gigantic, that could produce objects out of concrete, and then drop those in to provide a scaffold for coral to build up on top of. And so, you know, from very tiny, intimate things to things that could really have an impact on a sort of global scale, 3D printers can be applied to any of these problems.
Let me get back to our callers. And it looks like we have Paul from Wrightstown Township joining us on Radio Times. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, the first I heard of 3D printing, I think it was called Fintigraphy 3 or 4 years ago. And it seemed that it started in Texas, but was largely centered in terms of any meaningful use in Europe, and in particular in Germany. How is the United States doing in making use of this technology?
How do you want to take that?
Yeah, so actually the technology started, it had a couple of starts. One with Chuck Hull, who started stereolithography, which is probably what you're referring to. But there's also selective laser sintering. We started at Texas, Austin University, and FDM, which started in Minneapolis. There's quite a few different starts. The technology then moved, the metal 3D printing sort of was initially driven by European companies, that's true. And I think in the beginning decade or so, it was mostly driven by U.S. work. Europe has sort of recently joined in the metal 3D printing, which is revolutionizing aerospace and a couple of other big industries. Also, China is advancing very quickly. We just came back from a book tour in China, and the interest in this technology there is incredible. The government has put almost 10 times more money into research in this area compared to the U.S. federal government. The hacker space is being opened in China left and right overnight. I mean, the technology is sort of making very, very fast progress in China, and China is sort of intent on catching up and closing the gap and perhaps leading it in the future. So we'll see. It's really a global technology by now.
Melba, again, since you were on that trip to China, anything you want to add to that? I'm curious.
So yes, people like to say everything's bigger in Texas, but if you go to China, everything's a lot bigger. So if we think that we have large research universities in the U.S., the Chinese have a gigantic and very well-funded research university network, a gigantic population that I think is magnitudes larger than the size of the U.S. But what the 3D printing it has a very strong foothold in the U.S., and there's clearly a lot of innovative new technologies are being developed all around the world. But I think that any advanced industrialized nation, wherever that nation may be, is facing similar challenges and should do similar things to prepare the workforce. And so one thing that I see that keeps coming up again in the U.S. is that skilled labor, this is advanced manufacturing, a large component of it is in managing digital and design files. And then there's also a major component in sophisticated materials research. And so in my mind, we keep coming full circle back to this original challenge is we need an educated workforce.
Right.
And there's no shortcut around that. If the U.S. wants to remain competitive and lead the way and continue to keep the lead in advanced manufacturing, we need to invest in people, we need to invest in public schools, and we need to make sure that students are comfortable with the digital world.
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Joe, we haven't really talked about how 3D printing is affecting the world of art, but again, reading through a number of your articles, it seems that the art world is fascinated with 3D printing as the rest of us.
Yeah, it actually started out, there were some people who are sort of guerrilla artists, and they'd go into museums and they'd make these data capture scans of the famous sculptures. And, you know, what started out originally as sort of this underground movement has now gone mainstream. You have institutions like the Smithsonian opening up parts of their collection as 3D models that people can download and print for use in classrooms or to decorate their homes. So I think the art world on the traditional side is well represented. And then on the other side, you have people who are using these devices to create new art. So one artist is using these to make these fantastic dresses that would not be able to be produced in any other fashion, or to create paintings that sort of look like abstract Jackson Pollock works, but were created by robots. So it's really a broad spectrum of different applications.
You wrote about something called the Silk Pavilion, an architectural experiment constructed at MIT was 3D printed using 6,500 live silkworms. We probably can't do justice to what they were doing, but I guess just as another example of what 3D printing people are up to.
Yeah, this was an amazing project in MIT, and basically these researchers understood the biology of silkworms and understood the kinds of webs that they'd produce. So what they did was they set up just a rig, sort of like a sewing structure where there are a number of strings that were laid out, and then they released this swarm of bugs on top of it, and the bugs kind of filled in the gaps between these strings, and in result came up with this thing that looks sort of like an igloo, but really didn't have a designer in the traditional sense. It kind of came out of this emergent behavior of thousands and thousands of bugs.
We have an email from Gilbert, and this is to you, Hod. Can 3D printers print 4D printers?
I think, 3D printers can definitely make parts of new printers, and in that way sort of replicate. That was one of the original ideas behind a project called RepRap, which is a printer whose pieces can be printed by the same printer, so it can sort of replicate itself. But I think when people talk about 4D, it's a term that's been thrown around, really the idea is to print in new kinds of materials that are active. And I think that's where sort of the future of the technology is. It's moving from printing in plastic and metal and static parts to printing in materials that can move, that can respond, electronic materials, conductors, things like that. Imagine one of the things we're working in the lab is trying to print a complete robot that will walk out of the printer, batteries included. So that's a sort of, I think, the 4D idea is printing things that can move, that can respond, that are actually active.
We don't have time, but Melba, I'm tossing this quickly to you. We had a caller, Merrill from Elkins Park. Will 3D printing help with addressing hair loss? I didn't even think of that question. Is there an answer to that?
I don't think there's a quick and easy answer, but I think that if the technology advances enough that it can print a working hair follicle, and then at that point we're good to go. You can scan someone's head, you can figure out exactly where the hair should go, so there'll be a nice natural hairline, and then it could be sprayed on or attached somehow to the surface of the scalp.
Well, that is something to think about. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Melba Kerman and Hod Lipson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Their book is called Fabricated, The New World of 3D Printing, The Promise and Peril of a Machine That Can Make Almost Anything. Joe Flaherty, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He writes about design, DIY, and the intersection of physical and digital products for Wired. Lipson and Kerman, affiliated with Cornell University, joined us from their studios. And Joe designs award-winning medical devices and apps for smartphones at AGA Matrix. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.